With the senseless death of George Floyd and everything going on in the country, we decided to air an old episode from last year with Marcus Mason. Marcus is a senior partner in a Washington, D.C.-based lobbying firm, the Madison Group. He also serves as president of the Washington Government Relations Group, WGRG, an organization made up of African-American lobbyists that provide mentorship and professional growth opportunities for African-Americans while also promoting diversity within the lobbying profession. Marcus, first, thank you for taking the time to come back on the show. We are grateful to have you here. It has been an unprecedented week following the death of George Floyd. What are you feeling, and what are your thoughts?
Thanks for having me back, Jim. Look, first, let me say this. I'm the immediate past president of the Washington Government Relations Group now. I gleefully handed over the gavel to our immediate past vice president, Danielle McBeth. She is a talented lobbyist, lobbying for Florida A&M University, an HBCU in Florida. And our new vice president is E. Lance Williams, who is in government affairs over at British Petroleum. And so we've got a new, talented, young group of leaders. I really love their energy and really love what they're doing right now. As I sit back and look at what's going on over the last week, it reminds me of a conversation that I used to have with my dad when he was alive and my grandpa and grandparents. You live long enough to see history repeat itself. And so I may have talked about how I came into politics on the last show as a 21-year-old campaign manager, but what I may not have drilled down on was the timing. I ran my first campaign during the 92 riots, also known as the Rodney King riots or the Rodney King civil unrest. And back then, there were three words that sort of rang out then, and there are three words that ring out today. Those three words back then came from a rap group called NWA in a song titled Fuck the Police. So excuse the language, but that was the title of the song. And those three words were trying to explain the pain of young black males in the inner city and police brutality. There was a line that, the rapper Ice Cube said, where, he finished off, he said, fuck the police, and then said, coming straight from the underground, a young brother's got it bad because I'm brown. I'm not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fast forward to today, and the next three words, which are two sides of the same coin, I can't breathe, right? A black man in New York, Eric Garner, uttered these words first, I can't breathe, before his death. A black man in Minneapolis uttered these same words, I can't breathe. The difference is there was almost a 9-minute video of this man uttering these words while you watched a police officer sit on a subdued male with his knee on his neck, with a callousness that exuded from his body, with his hands in his pocket, with a smirk on his face. What most people didn't see, and photographs later showed, were three other officers who were sitting on top of this man's body. It does not take four police officers to keep still a person who was already subdued. I can't breathe should have been enough to get them off of him. I can't breathe should have been enough to let them know that he was close to meeting his maker. I can't breathe should have been the signal for any person to have just a little bit of humanity. I can't breathe should have been enough for one of those officers who we later found out knew George Floyd, had a prior relationship, or at least working relationship with him at a local nightclub, should have been enough to make them get off of him and understand that they were dangerously close to ending his life. But look, police in Minneapolis, just like police all around the country, have had a pattern and practice of being overly abusive with African-American males. I am an African-American male who has, regardless of the suit that I'm in or the clothes that I wear or the college sweatshirt that I may have been wearing at the time, has been made to sit on his knuckles on a curb with his full body weight. I've been made to lean onto the hot hood of a police car on my way to my office, a business that I own, while I'm being questioned about where I'm going, or while I'm being told that my taillight is out in a car that if the taillight is out, it's gonna tell you, right? So there is a pattern and practice among some law enforcement officers that when you give them a uniform, that they think that they have ultimate power. That's not the case. Police are paid by taxpayer dollars. They are hired to protect and serve, not to beat and kill. I Can't Breathe takes you back to the title of that NWA song. And while it was harsh and people focused on the harshness, they should have been focusing on the message that it was trying to send. And that way, I would not be reliving history right now from 1992 right up until 2020. Policies should have been put into place to stop that pattern and practice. And quite frankly, policies were put into place to stop that pattern and practice. They were actually repealed by the current commander in chief for whatever reason. But policies need to be put into place so that young Black men, young Black women, or people in general no longer have to suffer under police abuse. And I think the protests that you see today show that, you know, there were three words that came in between F the Police and I Can't Breathe, and that was Black Lives Matter. And Black lives truly have mattered for this country for a very long time. We just don't know if Black people have actually mattered to this country for a very long time. Look, African Americans built this country for free. And when we didn't do it fast enough, we were beaten. When my ancestors and our ancestors didn't do it good enough, sometimes they were killed. What you saw in Minneapolis was a modern day lynching. Except there was an iPhone or a smartphone to catch it on video. You know, this stuff has to end. And I talked about three words at the beginning, F the Police, three words in the middle, Black Lives Matter, and three words at the end, I Can't Breathe. But that comes down to one word, equity. For the sacrifices that African Americans have made for this country, whether it was helping to build it during the original sin of slavery, whether it was helping to fight to free it during revolutionary wars and civil wars, to form this quote unquote more perfect union that we are supposed to have now, out of that, there is an expectation of equity. And to this day, things have not changed for our folks. And equity is when you have a stake in something. Equity is when you have ownership. Equity is when you have a true piece of something. These protests and even the rioting that you saw, not so much the looting, because if you saw the looting, it wasn't African Americans looting, but the rioting and the protests that you saw stem from the fact that that expectation of equity is not there. That expectation to be a part of the quote unquote American dream, to have a stake in the quote unquote American dream, is not there yet. It hasn't been achieved. I said on your last show many times, and many times, that, you know, an African-American lobbyist is the only person that looks like them in a room full of 20 or 25. Sometimes it's two in a room of 40. That's not equity. And oftentimes they are paid less than their white counterparts. You know, there's a man who I truly admire. His name is Benny Thompson. He's from Mississippi. He's the chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. And I hosted an event for him during the first majority in 2007, first Democratic majority in 2000, or the last Democratic majority in 2007, with one of my fraternity brothers, William Clyburn. And in a room full of, I would say, 18 people sitting around a table, that's not including the congressman or the staff, there were two African Americans. And I appreciated what the congressman said that day, what the chairman said that day. He said to the group in the room, unabashedly, he said, some of you all at this table have retainers for very large amounts for managing one or two relationships. He said, while others of you all at this table, and he was referring to me and my fraternity brother, receive far, far less for being asked to manage 40 or 40 plus relationships. He ended it with three words: that's gonna change. And this man set out and worked to change that. His colleagues set out and worked to change that. His colleagues to this day are setting out and working to change that. But Black people trying to change systemic discrimination and inequities isn't enough. Our white counterparts have to look around and say, hey, you know, we've had a privilege for a long time. And that privilege is to learn about racism, to learn about discrimination, to learn about inequities without actually having to live that discrimination, that racism, or suffer from those inequities. That is what privilege is. And as we go forward, and the protests subside, and they will subside, those protests have to turn to purpose, and that purpose has to turn to power and then action, because these systemic inequities have to change. Or else, my daughter, who was born in 1992, just after the 1992 riots, may live long enough to see history repeat itself again. And if that's the case, we have truly failed as a nation if we have to relive history over and over and over and over and over again. F the police, Black Lives Matter, I can't breathe. Give equity to the people who deserve equity. You can deal with or wipe those other words right off the table, because once people have equity, it will show that, yes, Black lives truly matter. And you don't have to worry about not breathing. And if you don't have to worry about not breathing, you can have a respectful relationship with the police who are here to protect and serve. And that means the bad apples have been removed, but that also means that laws all the way down the books have changed. That restrictive covenants that prevent housing and affordable housing are wiped away. That redlining is wiped away. And look, and we have a responsibility to this too, to play our part, because that protest and passion to purpose and power and action needs to be voting. And not just voting at the top of the ticket, but voting all the way down the ballot to the bottom of the ballot. That's where all the devils are. You know, there's an old saying that the devil's in the details. Well, down ballot is where the devil rests, because that's where ballot initiatives are and propositions and things like that. That's where they lie. That's where there's local. That's where those local initiatives lie. That's where those local officials for commissions and board. That's where they rest. So, you know, I would say to my folks, when you vote, don't just stop at president. Don't just stop at Senate. Don't just stop at Congress. Don't even stop when you get to state Senate. Keep going. Vote to the bottom of the ballot. And if we vote to the bottom of the ballot, we can truly change things, because those votes will count. Those votes will matter, and policy, and we can hold those officials and those people accountable so that policies will change.
Marcus, thank you. Thank you for coming in. We're very grateful, and thank you for giving us all something to think about during this time, and something for us in the lobbying profession to give some serious thought to. And for the audience, here is now the original show with Marcus Mason. Thank you, Marcus.
Thank you.
So, Marcus, tell us about the Washington Government Relations Group.
The Washington Government Relations Group is an organization of African-American lobbyists whose goal is to both enrich one another, provide mentorship opportunities, and various professional growth opportunities, and to just really give the African-American lobbyist in Washington a sort of place and a venue. It started off many, many years ago as the Second Wednesday Group. A group of folks founded it, and it met informally on the second Wednesday of every month. And so it took on the name the Second Wednesday Group, and then their successors formalized it and made it into the Washington Government Relations Group, otherwise or commonly known as WGRG.
And who were some of the founding members?
Some of the original founding members were David Warr, who's still around town. He's actually the current chair of the WGRG Foundation. Anita Estelle, who was the first African-American female to ever be a partner at a lobbying firm in town or at a law firm in town. Yeah, both former Hill staffers, and John Chambers, who we actually have a golf tournament named after, the John Chambers Memorial Golf Tournament, and a few others who had a vision and saw the need for something like this, the need for a pipeline so that other lobbyists would come along behind them. There was a small handful back then, maybe a couple of dozen or so, and now we're at a few hundred today.
Wow. Individual members.
A few hundred individual members, yes. I think the last count might have been 475.
And how do you go about promoting diversity?
We go about promoting diversity in a number of different ways. One, we have the organization itself has a diversity task force that is co-chaired by Marie Silla, who's a lobbyist for T-Mobile and a former Hill staffer, and Don Cravens, who was one of the few African-American chiefs of staff over on the Senate side, and then went over to the National Urban League and is now over at Charter Communications in their public affairs department. And so we actually put together events throughout the year. We work with a number of different similar organizations, the Hispanic Lobbyist Association, the Asian Pacific Lobbyist Association. And yeah, there are a few diverse groups around town, Women in Government Relations. So we work with them, and we put on these events that really help create a pipeline. So one pipeline would exist that we try to work with, or that we try to build, is the one from Capitol Hill to K Street. Mm-hmm. And of course, you have several people who are the beneficiaries of such a pipeline, like Ernie Jolly over at the Mortgage Bankers Association, John Jones over at the National Association of Real Estate Investment Trust. Marie Silla herself was a beneficiary of that pipeline coming from Capitol Hill to go over to T-Mobile. And so that's the first pipeline that we try to create. The second pipeline, of course, is that pipeline that allows people to not just move off Capitol Hill, but to move up in their professions, to not just become a lobbyist, but ultimately to become a top lobbyist, whether that is an assistant vice president in their association or a company, or a vice president in their association or company, or ultimately head of office at their association or their company. And we've had a lot of success in that regard.
And the events, are they networking type or panel discussions or
combination
educational
of both.
Or a combination?
They're a combination of both, you know, because what's worth doing, you might as well have a little fun at it because nobody wants to be talked at. But, you know, one of the things about our business, one of the things about the lobbying profession is that it is all about relationships and all about networking. So while we do have panels and structured panels that provide, you know, great professional advice, lots of good Q&A, we also make time for networking and socializing and things like that. And so one of the particular programs that we have and that we've built out over the years has been the Table Talk series. And with the Table Talk series, we have a senior government relations professional come in, like a Fred Humphreys from Microsoft, who's head of office at Microsoft, or Gina Adams, who's the head of office at FedEx, or Didi Lea, who's the head of office over at Viacom, or Stephanie Childs, who's been head of office at several different companies, come over, and then we bring a younger group of lobbyists together who really want to learn. And they talk about, and those senior lobbyists talk about their career paths, how they got to where they are. They talk about the pitfalls. They talk about the successes, the failures. And it really gives the younger lobbyists an opportunity to kind of learn from the best, you know, to get best practices from the people who are best in class in their profession.
And you mentioned Ernie Jolly. That's how we found you. Ernie is a listener of the show and reached out to us and said, I've listened to the show. You really should interview Marcus. And I said, great. That's how we got to you. And you and your group were a mentor to Ernie and others.
Ernie is one of the bright talents in this city. He may have made some of the wrong fraternal choices in life, but that's okay. But he is truly one of the bright talents in this city. He was deputy chief of staff for a great member out of New York, Congressman Gregory Meeks, who's just a great member of the House Financial Services Committee and a very astute member of the House Foreign Affairs Committee.
You know, as I heard you describe that event, that would be an interesting podcast show to have, to air one of those events, one of those table talks.
Sure, we'd love to have you. We'd love to have you come in and air one.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's really a great experience. It was something that was put into place before I became head of the organization, but something that I really wanted to blow out and grow and really put some emphasis on, because you can't, if you don't have the exposure to people like that, you never even know to hope and dream and to aspire to reach those levels.
And you don't know how to begin. You don't know how to start.
And you don't know how to start.
Yeah.
You don't know how to start. And sometimes you have unrealistic expectations. You know, I've had staffers come to me, Young Hill staffers come to me and say, you know, Marcus, I want to leave the Hill today as a legislative assistant and go lobby and make $500,000. You know, I have to take a breath before I burst out into laughter. But, you know, I always tell them, you have to walk before you run. And you have to crawl before you walk.
And usually for a while.
And usually for a while. But
unfortunately,
you have to set expectations for people so that they can manage their own expectations. Because, you know, one of the things that you don't want is for someone to come out, leave Capitol Hill, and think that lobbying is something that it is not, and to think that the salary expectations or the workload is something that it isn't. And lobbying also, it's not easy. You know, it's not easy.
Since you touched on that, let's take a little tangent. What do you think are some of the important trademarks of a good lobbyist?
I think some of the important trademarks of a good lobbyist, someone who can inspire a great deal of trust. I always say that 50% of my job as a lobbyist and advocate is advocating for my company or client. 50% of it is advocating for my company or client to Capitol Hill. The other 50% is advocating Capitol Hill to the company or the client. Because let's face it, Capitol Hill doesn't speak corporate. Corporate doesn't necessarily speak government. And so one of the best traits of a lobbyist is to be almost a translator and provider of information.
And one guest said, and to be honest and straightforward with your client.
Absolutely.
About the reality of what's going on the Hill.
Absolutely. You have to be honest and straightforward with your client. You have to let them know this is actually what's going on. These are the actual feelings about the company. And don't try to sugarcoat it, because sugarcoating perception isn't helpful to the client. And as a chief of staff, and I guess I got this early, being a chief of staff so young, speaking truth to power was fairly easy and has become fairly easy over time, so much so that over the course of my career at Amtrak, I worked with 5 different CEOs. All 5 of the CEOs trusted me because they knew that I would always tell them the truth.
So speaking truth to power for you was easy.
It is.
And so for lobbyists to do their job, they have to learn how to do that, or they
have to learn how to do that.
Yeah. Okay.
You have to get comfortable with doing it. And it takes practice. And so you take those measured steps in doing it, and you develop your own style in doing it. I know some lobbyists who like to give their client a little bit of the information to let it sink in. Mm-hmm. And then they come back a little while later and really lay it on. And it really depends on the client, or depends on the company that you're with, or the executive that's managing you, or whether you're that person that has to report to the CEO. It really depends on the temperament of that person. And that's something that you learn to read over time. It's not something that you get automatically. But what I will say is those lobbyists who have worked for a member of Congress on Capitol Hill and have had to deliver both good news and bad news usually learn it right then and there, and they're equipped to come out into the private sector and kind of do the same thing.
So it's okay if they deliver it in different ways and in different methods, just as long as they deliver it.
Just as long as they deliver it.
Right. I like that. Getting back to the Washington Government Relations Group, the association, tell us about the Tin Cup Dinner.
That's one of the things that, being president of the organization, that I'm probably the most proud of. The Tin Cup Awards, we just celebrated our 10th annual event. The Tin Cup Awards celebrates and honors those who advocate for diversity. The reason it's called the Tin Cup Awards is because, but for those individuals who advocate and push for diversity, we might not sit and drink from the nice crystal glasses that we all get to drink from here in Washington, but instead, those of us who are minorities in the lobby profession may be drinking from a humble tin cup. But for those individuals, we could be drinking from that tin cup, and that's why we actually called it the Tin Cup Awards. So every year in July, and it's always in July, and it's always on a Wednesday, we host a gala dinner, and we honor a member from the House, a member from the Senate, a member from, you know, sometimes we honor a staff member. We also honor a member from the press. And then we also talk about those lobbyists of the year, and we also give an award for lifetime achievement.
Wow.
So it's a great event.
Where is it held?
So we have held it in a number of different places. The very first one was held at the Embassy of Finland. And the Embassy of Finland was so proud to have us hold the dinner there that they actually hosted it themselves. They funded the cost of the dinner themselves, and we took the proceeds and we put the proceeds into the Terry Greer Memorial Scholarship Fund. And that really allowed us to just get a great start with that dinner. And so we've had it at the Embassy of Finland. We've had it at the French Embassy a number of times, and the ambassadors always come and speak, and they love having it. We've also had it at the House of Sweden. We've held it for the last few years at the Canadian Embassy. And then just recently, we had our 10th anniversary event over at the museum after the Canadian officials told us that we actually outgrew their space.
Wow. And tell us about the scholarship fund.
The Terry Greer Memorial Scholarship Fund is a fund that's administered by the Washington Government Relations Group Foundation. So we do have a nonprofit arm, a 501c3, that awards these scholarships. And it gives young men and young women, college-age students, and now we're even reaching into the graduate ranks, who are interested in government affairs, government or its complement, political science or its complement. We provide a scholarship to those students so that they can, A, be exposed to the profession of government relations, but B, the cost of college is so high, we just want to make sure people can get through school. So, you know, my philosophy was lobbyists do well, so let's do some good. And that's why we pushed the scholarship forward. I think this past year, or at this last dinner, we gave away 2 $10,000 scholarships to students, one of which who couldn't be here. And so he actually did a video chat from South Africa where he was off doing an internship.
And do you have students reaching out to you who are looking for internships on the Hill?
We have both. So we have students who reach out to us, but we also actively market our programs on social media, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. We work with Pan-Hellenic organizations. We work with the various universities, Thurgood Marshall Scholarship Fund, and a number of others. We even work with the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation that has its own scholarship and internship program. But for students that may still have a need, we continue to market and cross-market with those organizations. And then we also have students, because we've been doing it now for and had success now for a decade, we also have students reaching out to us. I believe we awarded our 41st and 42nd scholarship this last year, as well as provided our first two internships.
And as an industry, how are we doing in regards to diversity?
A lot better today and a lot better this year than we were last year, and a lot better last year than the year before. I mean, we've seen with the incredible growth in the number of members in the Congressional Black Caucus and the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and what is called known as the Tri-Caucus, and really with Democrats taking over the majority, we saw two things. One, we saw a talent pool from the Hill that could actually leave and come out and do these jobs. And then two, we saw more offices, whether they be associations, companies, or lobbying firms, see the need for diversity. So we're doing a whole lot better. You know, again, we talked about Ernie Jolly earlier. He, just last year, was a staffer for Congressman Greg Meeks. We talked about John Jones earlier. Just last year, he was chief of staff for Congressman Emanuel Cleaver. Today, both members have gavels on the House Financial Services Committee. You know, there's Francesca Cox, there's Ariadne Williams, there's a number of new and talented lobbyists walking around Washington right now. Nana Nayan, Kyle Williams, who's now the head of office at Oplones, was a staffer for Marsha Fudge before going to the Urban League and is now at Oplones. My wife, my very own wife, Christina Mason, who was a staffer for Congresswoman Yvette Clark, who sits on the Energy and Commerce Committee, she was at the American Institute of Architects, and now she's the head of office at the wireless internet service providers. And so we have seen a growth in both the number of heads of office. Nicole Francis just yesterday was announced as the new head of office for the Interstate Natural Gas Association. And so we've seen some growth. We've seen a great deal of expansion, and we're not going to go backwards from there. I think our pipeline efforts are showing some success. I think our table talk efforts are showing some success. I think our work with some of the search firms out there, with Julian Hyde, Hydrogen Struggles, and Corn Ferry, and then with Conrad Woody at his new firm, I think we've seen some success there at identifying good, solid candidates who can go in, interview well, and then get the job, but not just get the job, do the work and do the work well.
Now let's talk about your career. I think you still hold the honor of the youngest top staffer in Congress. Is that correct?
I do.
Youngest
I
chief
do,
of staff?
Unfortunately. Unfortunately?
Why unfortunately?
Because I really want to see some young person break that record.
I think it's going to be hard. You were how old?
I was 22 years old. So
that's a hard record to break.
I ran and won my first congressional campaign when I was 21.
And that was in California?
I was in California.
Okay.
For then mayor, who would become Congressman Walter Tucker. He was the mayor of Compton. And so it was one of those moments, you know, it's like a Disneyland moment. He said, okay, you just won your first congressional campaign. What do you want to do? And with everything I had in me, I looked at him and I said, I want to be an intern. And he looked at me and said, oh, no. He said, come back to me tomorrow with something else. So I went home and talked to my folks, and my stepfather at the time, or now my late stepfather, had actually served in the Reagan administration. And he had served with Jack Kemp over at HUD. And he knew about, of course, he knew about the title chief of staff. Uh-huh. And he talked about his friends who were chiefs of staff and different things like that. And he said, son, you ought to be chief of staff. So I went back the next day and I said, okay, I want to be your chief of staff. And he said, that's what I wanted to hear. And, you know, we went out and and came to Congress, and the rest is pretty much history.
That's incredible. You went from one day asking to be an intern and come back the next day and asking to be the top staffer or chief of staff, and he said yes.
He said yes because I was his top staffer on the campaign.
That's incredible.
So he said, why would you ever go backwards from the gains that you've made?
He said, you know, great advice from your stepdad.
Yeah, no, from my stepdad and a really great opportunity from Congressman Tucker, just to take a risk on a young person.
And what you were talking about earlier, exposure.
Exposure, absolutely.
Right. Can we back up a little bit?
Sure.
What was your first, so he was the mayor of Compton. What was your first exposure to government or politics? Obviously, how did you get involved in the campaign? How did you get to know the mayor? How did it all, what was your first government political exposure?
So my first exposure to politics was on a state Senate campaign in California, a guy named Paul Richards. He was running for state Senate in California, 25th District. I remember it just like it was yesterday. And I got to be a field organizer. And I got to help, got to be a field organizer and help on the fundraising side. And it was fun. It was great. And so I was in City Hall one day because I was actually interning for the city attorney at the time, Wes Fenderson. And so while I'm getting on the elevator and Walter's getting off the elevator, the mayor's getting off the elevator, and we literally bump into each other, and he hands me a card and he says, "Hey man, I'm running for Congress. I need your help." And I said, "Okay." So he hands me a card and walks off. I go home, talk to my family, and said, "The mayor said he's running for Congress. He wants me to help him." So my mother looked at me and she said, "You ought to be his campaign manager." And I said, "Well, I've never run a campaign." She said, "But you've worked on the campaign." She said, you have great leadership skills, and I'm sure that you can do this. And so I went back, and we had a long conversation about it. And he took me out. He took me with him to a speech, and he opened up his trunk, and he said, "Hey, make sure all these collaterals get out over are all distributed." And I looked, and I said, "Well, that's not what a campaign manager does," just instinctively. And so I saw these two kids who were out playing in the lobby, and I said, "Hey, you two, come with me." And I said, "I need you to distribute and pass out all of these all over the place, and I'll give you $20 for it." And so the kids jumped at the opportunity. While they were doing that, I walked inside the ballroom and listened to a speech, took notes on some of the things that he said and some of the things that I liked and that I didn't like, and then went back out to check on the progress. So he comes out maybe 10 minutes after that, and he looks around. He's like, "Wow, you're fast." And I said, "No, I paid them to do it." And he was like, and he slapped me on the back. He's like, "Wow, you're good. That's what I wanted to see.
You are a manager."
And so, you know,
pretty good.
He took me back to his office and he said, we stand at the front of the campaign office and he said, "What do you see?" And I said, "Well, I can tell you what I don't see." And this was all based on having been an organizer and doing some of the fundraising work for Paul Richards. And I looked and I said, "Well, I'll tell you what I don't see. I don't see anyone on the phone banks. I don't see any organization around the call sheets." And back then, everything was really paper-based. And I said, "I don't see any organization around the call sheets. I don't see any real life." I said, there's a better way to do this. And he said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Okay." Well, he walks down through the office, walks into his personal office, and looks out and says, "Gang, that's Marcus. He's the new campaign manager. Marcus, this is the gang. Let's go win."
Wow. That's great. And so when you come to Capitol Hill, what is it like to be the chief of staff for a congressman? What is the Hill like? Give our listeners just a feel for what that's like.
So the Hill, let me tell you, as a 22-year-old from Los Angeles, California, coming to Washington, D.C., the Hill was just this big place. They did an orientation for us in the caucus room of the Cannon House office building. And at that point, then Speaker of the House, Tom Foley, walks in. And these are people that you've read about in your political science courses and in your government classes and positions that you've seen. And Tom Foley, Speaker Foley, walks in, and it's to a group of young chiefs and young senior staffers, and he says two things that have stuck with me to this day. He pointed out at the Capitol, and he said, "If at any day or at any moment that you look up at that building and you don't see a sense of awe, it's time for you to leave this, time for you to leave the city. The second thing that he said was, Republicans are our opposition and they are loyal. The Senate is our enemy. And so those were the types of things that I learned, you know, coming in. But let me tell you the other thing. The Hill is one big community. It is one large campus. I have met some of the best friends that I've ever had, that I will ever have in life on Capitol Hill. Just the other day, a group of us were together, and the first people I met on the Hill were Darlene Taylor, Joyce Brayboy, and Yebby Watkins. Not in that particular order. In fact, it was Joyce Brayboy who was the first person that I had met on Capitol Hill. And we have been friends to this day. That was in 1993. We have been friends and like family ever since. Not like family, you know, because your friends are the family you choose. So that's the other thing about the Capitol that I think is missed by most Americans, that we work together so well because we have such great relationships with one another. There is such a great deal of trust with one another, and someone who you care about, you're never going to try to harm. These are real people here. They're not avatars on social media. They're not images that you see on Facebook or in a newspaper. These are real people with real lives. We all care about each other. You know, Yebby is like a big brother to me. Joyce is like a big sister, has always been like a big sister to me. I know his nieces. My oldest daughter is a niece to him and really close with his friends. So that's the other thing about the Capitol. It's a very close-knit place. It's a very close-knit ecosystem. We know each other. We worship with each other. We eat together. We pray together. We celebrate babies together. We attend weddings together. It's just really, really, really a wonderful place and filled with the best and brightest minds and the sharpest thinkers and the best hearts that you'll ever find in this country.
And when we're in contentious times like now, is it hard to have those relationships for the staffers across the aisle?
I think it's hard, but I think it still goes on. It still goes on.
Because the work has to be done.
I mean, these are very, very committed people to their bosses, to their districts, their states, and to the country. And, you know, yes, they do a great job of clearing out the noise and trying to clear out the noise just so that they can continue to work together. This hypersense of partisanship that exists today because of social media and some in the 24-hour news cycle, it creates a false narrative about the work of government and about the work of governing and about politics. Now, you know, politics is always involved in every decision. But look, at the end of the day, the pendulum swings from right to left, but it always comes through the center, right? And so that's what in the center is where both sides come together to work and get things done.
How long did you spend on the Hill?
I was there from 1993. January 3rd, 1993 was the official start until November 1999.
When you were 22.
Started when I was 22.
Marcus, that's incredible.
And I was wet behind the ears too. So a lot of good people and a lot of good mentors. Carlotta Scott was just she was chief of staff for Ron Dellums at the time. She was just a great mentor to me. Lorraine Miller, she worked for Speaker Foley, who went on to be the clerk of the House, was just a great mentor to me.
And so you told us what the community is like. What's the toughest part of the job that you remember?
The toughest part of the job, really, probably managing
the office,
managing the staff and the expectations. And Carlotta told me when I first started, she said, Marcus, if they were all robots, everything would be easy. She said, but they're people, and they're subject to all the quirks and foibles that people are subject to, and they have all the expectations and wants that people have. And so you have to manage that every day as much as you have to manage the process and the politics.
Yep.
And so, you know, much like relationships are the best part of it, best part of the Hill, and the best part of Washington, relationships can also be the hardest part, the interpersonal.
Right.
Because you do have to deal with people. These offices are not big, right? The West Wing has everybody believing that these offices are big and grand and palatial. No, they're—
And doing a lot of walking around.
And doing a lot of walking around, no. Right. No, these offices are actually small and compact, and you work with people on a day-to-day basis. You get to know people sometimes a little better than you want to get to know them.
And I would imagine that being the chief of staff was great training for what you do now, because you saw firsthand what didn't work and what did work when
Absolutely.
People would come in and see you.
Absolutely. I got to see what worked and what didn't work. And, you know, I always say my life is tied together, you know, through a number of different experiences. And playing free safety at Arizona State, you know, was also very helpful in even being chief of staff, because you could sit back and watch.
That is a good description. I like that. And kind of figure out where you needed to go, fill the hole.
Exactly. Figure out where you need to go.
Where the problem was.
And then go over and solve for X, and then get right back to your position and, yeah. and not get beat deep.
Right. So you spent a number of years at Amtrak.
Yes.
What was that like?
You know, it was great. It was great. It was a great place to cut my teeth in lobbying, because I learned a few things. I learned how to manage a brand. A big brand. I mean, Amtrak back then, you know, had become part of the country's sort of nomenclature for train, mm-hmm. much like Xerox became the nomenclature for making a copy. And Google is now, you know, part of the lexicon for looking something up. Yep. Amtrak was part of the country's lexicon just for trains. Oh, that's an Amtrak. No. That's a Burlington Northern Santa Fe train. Oh, well, Amtrak is a train. Right, but it's a brand. So learning to manage a big national brand that operated in 46 states and more than 550 communities that had different lines of services was great. And really at the time when high-speed rail was being introduced to this country, it's not so new to the rest of the world, but high-speed rail is still fairly new and still in its infancy in this country. So I got to work on some great projects like the Cascades and the Pacific Surfliner and Amtrak's Acela service. You know, so I was there to help launch all three and to inform Capitol Hill about them. But really, you know, Amtrak also taught me some other things about lobbying that I never expected.
What's that?
You know, so back then, members of the House and Senate would take trains to their various retreats. And so, you know, the House Democrats would go down. Or no, the Senate Republicans would go up to the Greenbrier. Sometimes the House Republicans would go up to the Greenbrier. And then the House Dems would go down to a resort in Williamsburg. And, you know, they would all take the trains in various ways. I mean, to each of the destinations. And I would always have to be on the train. And somebody once said to me, wow, it must be great to be on the train with all those members. You get to lobby them all. I said, I don't lobby anybody. They said, well, what do you do? I said, I actually sit back and watch. I watch who sits with whom, who talks to whom, who plays cards, who plays bitwist, who sits with their wife, who plays poker, who sits with their kids, who sits alone. You sort of watch what they eat, what they don't eat. And, you know, you're there as a resource if you need to be, but you don't want to be overbearing because you have them in a captive environment. And that's where I really learned about the relationships. In Washington, if you saw the same four members sitting together over the course of a 2 or 3 hour or 4 hour trip, you knew they pretty much liked each other. You knew they liked each other. And you knew they shared a common bond with one another. And if you saw it over and over, you knew that became a power center. And that if you wanted to get something done, you go talk to this one and you could pretty much pick up the other three or four around them. So I learned a lot from those trips.
This could be an episode of West Wing. Marcus, I bet you are very good at your job. That is great. And tell us about your current firm.
Yeah, my current firm, the Madison Group, started it with my partner, Rob Waters. We started it, actually came up with the idea while I was at Amtrak. And Rob's a Republican from Virginia. I'm a Democrat from Los Angeles. You know, and we were sitting over his house. He invited me over for a barbecue contest between he and one of my fraternity brothers, who's now chief of staff, who's currently the chief of staff for a member on the House side, who was a lobbyist.
Who won the barbecue contest?
You know, they're both friends, so... and because I'm a Californian, I appreciate all sorts of barbecue. Neither of their offerings was better than mine. But both were very good. But really, over actually a bottle of moonshine... we actually discussed forming a partnership and putting together a firm. And, you know, a few weeks later, a few months later, actually, we put it together and we did it. And the Madison Group is a bicameral, bipartisan, bicoastal firm. So we do work not just in Washington, but we also do work before the California State Legislature in California, as well as the City of Los Angeles and the County of Los Angeles. You know, I always like to say that we specialize in the T's, the tax, tech, telecom, trade, and transportation. We represent companies, countries, and even a few counties. Yeah, I like to just tie everything up with a nice little elevator pitch. But we really got to have a great team of people. We try to keep the team small and tight. And we've done some great work for some clients that you've, or for some companies that you've probably never heard of, but then a lot of companies that you see and hear about all the time. I've really enjoyed this last 11 years of my life.
Well, you just answered my next question, which was, when did you form the firm? So about 11 years ago.
So actually, it's back in 2007, so 12 years ago, and this is 2019.
If college students are listening and interested in doing an internship on the Hill, we've talked about the association, the group that you have, mm-hmm. and also maybe your firm. Do you also have internships at your firm?
So we do. We provide internships at our firm. In fact, we have 2 interns now. We had 3 over the summer, but we have an intern from the John McCain Institute at Arizona State University, which is my alma mater. And then we have another intern from the Washington Institute. And so we always try to make sure that we give young people exposure, that we give them a great opportunity to see not just how Capitol Hill works, but how K Street works. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we treat them just like junior associates. We give them business cards. We send them up to hearings. They attend client meetings with us. Sometimes when we feel comfortable, we let them go on their own. And we really try to give them the full, you know, a very full and very well-rounded experience. You know, they get to meet members of Congress. They get to take photographs with them. One of the young men from the summer, you know, got to attend a meeting with myself and Mark Morial, who's the president and CEO of the Urban League, and at a meeting with Senator Van Hollen. He left that meeting and said, you know, I want to run for office someday. Having taken a picture being sandwiched between these 2 great men, it made him feel like he wanted to go out and do something great himself. And so that's what we really try to do for our interns. We try to, again, the exposure quotient. My mother always taught me the exposure quotient. Carter G. Woodson, you know, said that a mind once expanded beyond its original parameters can never again regain its original form. And so we try to make sure that these kids, that we really try to blow their minds. And so that when they leave us, they go off and they continue to do, you know, they continue that momentum and continue to do good things. And we keep in touch with our interns. We talk to, I would say, of the interns that we've had over the last 12 years, we probably keep in touch with about 75% of them on a regular basis. They come back to the office. We help them get placed. We write letters of recommendation for graduate school, law school, business school. We write letters of recommendation for jobs and positions. And we have a few working around town now. A few former interns working around town now. And we've got some that are, you know, out in Silicon Valley. We have former interns who are, you know, completing their legal studies. So we try to give them a chance, give them some exposure, and then push them out.
Well, Marcus, on that note, this has been great. Thank you for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
It was great to have you on the show. And thank you for Ernie Jolly for reaching out.
Yeah, no. Ernie's a great guy. Ernie's a great guy. Again, you know, not everybody makes the right fraternal choices, but he made the right professional choice.
All right, Marcus, thank you.
Thank you.